All right. Thank you very much, Aaron. Appreciate that. And good day, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us today for the monthly UBS CIO House View webcast. I am Anthony Pastore. I'm the head of broadcast communications here at UBS. In the latest UBS House View publication, the Chief Investment Office analyzed how overall health, monetary, and fiscal policy will impact markets in the coming months. Today, we will discuss the potential scenarios that might play out over those coming months, as well as current market opportunities. Welcome our guests today, and let me tell you who those folks are. That is Mike Ryan, Chief Investment Officer Americas, Salita Marcelli, Deputy Chief Investment Office Americas, and John Savercool, the head of the UBS U.S. Office of Public Policy. Mike, Salita, and John, so happy to have you join me today on the webcast. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Anthony.
Thank you.
So today is Thursday, April 2nd, 2020. Before we begin, I'd like to say, of course, on behalf of everyone at UBS, I hope that you and your families are safe and healthy during this unprecedented time. And many of my colleagues, including all of us on the phone, are also working at home remotely and, you know, really trying to be observant of the social distancing and the staying at home policies. So so we're all doing our best to stay safe and healthy and connect with our families and friends as well. So before we begin, I wanted to let you know that we will provide you, as we always do on this monthly call, with the opportunity to ask questions of our panel of experts. So if you are on the webcast, as was said at the very beginning, you'll have an option to type a question on the site where it says ask a question. You can also send an email directly to wmrfeedback@ubs.com. And if you are on the phone and you'd like to join the webcast, you can visit our website at ubs.com/CIO Live. That's CIOLIVE. And there's a link right at the bottom of the screen to join the webcast there. And one more housekeeping note before we start, we are not authorized to discuss any single securities on this broadcast today. So if you do have any questions, we always advise that you reach out directly to your UBS financial advisor. And also follow Mike Ryan on LinkedIn. There is an amazing amount of content that's coming out from the Chief Investment Office that Mike is posting on his profile there on the LinkedIn site. All right, so John Savercool, let me ask you to kick us off here. What are the latest measures that are being discussed by the government to combat the spread of the virus and prepare our health systems? And also, maybe you can explain how the federal government is working with the state and local governments and what authority each has in terms of enacting and enforcing a lot of these social distancing restrictions.
Yeah, Anthony, there's a lot going on, not only at the federal government, but in all the individual state governments. Both have widespread emergency powers that most have granted so far over the course of the last month. The federal government declared a national emergency a couple of weeks ago. They also declared a health emergency. And in most states, they have declared their own state of emergency. All of these emergency declarations trigger different assistance and different actions that the states or the federal government can do to protect their citizens. Most of them are not overlapping. The states can impose, and most have imposed, social distancing requirements. They can get involved in the closure of businesses and schools. The feds can be in charge of making sure that all the equipment that America needs, and you've seen massive purchases of equipment that the feds have made. The feds can also impose travel restrictions, and I think, frankly, that may be the next shoe to drop. You may see some restrictions on air travel, not necessarily widespread, but in certain markets, certain populated markets where the level of infection is highest. So there's kind of a broad set of emergency powers that both the state and the federal governments have. Traditionally, the states have acted first in terms of most emergencies. In this case, they seem to be doing it in sync. And in fact, both have to act effectively to really make this all work, given the nature of this emergency. So a lot going on every day. This is a huge challenge for any state and the federal government. These are not things they work on all the time. In many cases, this is the first time that some of these governors and maybe some in the executive branch here have ever worked on these issues. So it's a tough task, but the job will get done.
Great. Thank you, John. And Mike Ryan, let's talk about the Chief Investment Office's base case. In terms of when the virus will peak, obviously, when you listen to medical professionals, it looks like we haven't quite peaked yet here in the U.S. And also, maybe you can talk about the expected course for the economy and the markets over the rest of the year.
Thanks, Anthony. Let me just pick up on some of the things that John said, because I think when we talk about base cases for the virus peaking, we also have to appreciate that the dynamics are changing on the ground. In other words, John alluded to both the social distancing and the mobility restrictions that are being imposed. And let's also remember that they're happening at different speeds across different countries, and even within a country, across different jurisdictions. We've certainly seen that in the United States, where certain states have been more restrictive than others. So it means then that trying to forecast exactly when the peak in this, the viral count will be, is really difficult to do. However, what we do see is when we look across globally, the measures that are being put in place and have been in place, our base case now is that we will see the virus peaking in mid to late April. Now, I want to be careful here, Anthony. When I say peaking in mid to late April, it doesn't mean that, you know, we've solved all our issues and that we immediately go back to normal. It simply means that we begin to see the process of what's commonly been called bending the curve, or slowly beginning to flatten the curve in terms of the infection rate. So to us, it's an important inflection point. It's when that second derivative, think about it, turns negative. That's a really critical point. And again, we think that happens in mid to late April. As I said, it happens a little bit different speeds across different countries, because remember, this emerged in different countries at different times. Now, we think if that's the case, then we'll start to see is some of the more severe restrictions will be lifted, you know, between mid and late May. Although what we will see, of course, is that the virus is not going to be stamped out immediately. You know, it's going to be really hard to eradicate, which means that certain restrictions may be reimposed intermittently in some countries if they find that there's a reoccurrence of the disease. Now, what we also expect to see against that backdrop, and let me focus now on the macro and market side, what we have seen and what we expect to continue to see is a massive mobilization of monetary and fiscal resources. This is one of the most extraordinary responses, not just here in the U.S., but across the globe. And in our view, this is absolutely critical to make sure that we backstop the most heavily affected segments of our population, and then also the most acutely affected industries within the economy as well. So it's both on the monetary and the fiscal side. You know, we just recently passed a $2.2 trillion fiscal stimulus package. Our view is that's not likely to be the last. We're likely to see additional fiscal measures employed. But I do think that combination of monetary and fiscal policy working in tandem will be effective in mitigating some of the impact here in terms of the coronavirus crisis. Now, we are expecting, therefore, to see what we call a U-shaped economic recovery, where we're going to get a pretty sharp drop in economic activity in the second quarter. In fact, the second quarter is likely to be one of the worst quarters on record, certainly in the post-war era. And a lot of people are going to look at this as, you know, one of the worst quarters ever. Because remember, what we're seeing, Anthony, is an intentional shutdown of economic activity in order to deal with the public health crisis. So in order to deal with the first issue, the public health crisis, you actually have to delay trying to re-stimulate your economy, because you need to make sure that you first do as much as you can to contain the disease. Only then you start to focus on the economy. So that's why we expect to see a U-shape. So by the third quarter, we should see some signs of improvement, and then recovery in the fourth quarter. So by year-end, what does this mean for markets? It means then that the S&P 500 will be volatile. We're going to see lots of volatility over the course of the next couple of months, especially as we still start to map out exactly when this peak will be in terms of the viral count and when we start to see these mitigation efforts bear fruit. So expect to see some volatility. But by the end of the year, we do expect to see the S&P 500 trading higher. Our base case is for an S&P target of 2650 by the end of the year. So again, from the economic perspective, this U-shaped recovery, the worst quarter is going to be the second quarter, begin to see some signs of improvement in the third quarter, and then recovery in the fourth. And by the end of the year, we have equity markets moderately higher than where they are today.
Terrific. Thank you, Mike. And Salita, let me bring you in. This week and last, we've continued to see this sharp volatility, but also there are some signs of perhaps market normalization, if I could use that word. What are you watching right now to see if this particular trend will continue?
Yeah, thanks, Anthony. So the rally we have seen in the markets has been due to the rapid response by Fed and fiscal authorities, as John and Mike talked about. to roll out an unprecedented stimulus program. Before Fed came in on Monday of last week, credit markets were frozen, and this contributed to how fast the equity market sold off. It seems now that at least Fed actions has resolved that part of the problem, namely trying to prevent a financial crisis beyond the medical and economic one we're facing. So first indicators we should be watching is whether credit, fixed income, and currency markets are functioning well and they're not contributing to further sell-off. Then comes the more difficult part, tracking the virus and its spread, and finally, of course, the economic effect of the crisis. We have all become amateur epidemiologists here trying to track the global pandemic. On that front, three signs are important. One is, how is the virus behaving in Italy and Spain, which went into lockdowns first? And the second is, here in the U.S., will there be other hotspots beyond New York and New Orleans and a few others? And as a third one, will the virus return to Asia, to Japan and South Korea, which have so far seemed to have contained it well? So finally, I would say on the economic front, it probably is too early to say what the signs might be, as we're actually trying to keep most economic activity down, and Mike explained it pretty well. The numbers will be pretty bad for a while, but more important thing is when we can open back up, and if the stimulus will be enough to bring back economic activity to prior levels. But that is still a few months away. The main things we're watching, the numbers that are relatively more reliable, and not a lot of numbers are reliable when the economy is in a shutdown, are the unemployment claims, which we saw the number earlier today, which was obviously historically high, and also bank lending numbers as well.
And so, Lita, just clearly, as Mike stated, we don't know exactly when the virus will peak here in the U.S., maybe, as he said, mid to late April. But so volatility is not necessarily behind us at this point, just because we've had a few sessions of slightly more normal markets.
Yes, volatility will be with us for the next couple of weeks, but probably for the next couple of months.
Terrific. So, John, let me bring you back in, and let's talk about the CARES Act that was signed by President Trump last week, the $2.2 trillion fiscal policy. What's the significance of the act, John? And could we see, that was phase three, because there were two other smaller phases behind it. Could we see more stimulus on the way, a phase four?
Yeah, I think it's very possible and not yet likely, but maybe it will soon be likely that there will be another stimulus bill. The stimulus bill that was passed into law and or that was signed into law last week is regarded as stimulus three. That came together in a bipartisan way. I think lawmakers kind of put aside their more partisan interest and adopted a number of provisions that they didn't fully agree with, but they thought were necessary in this time of emergency. So that's a good sign that the system can act on behalf of the people in such short notice. The Senate, House, and the President signed it into law within 5 days, which is a really impressive speed, at least by the standards of Washington. So this bill has virtually everything in it that most people wanted. There's assistance for small businesses. There's assistance for large businesses. There's assistance for workers. There's assistance for healthcare workers. There's assistance to the healthcare system overall. Hospitals get a lot of money. The unemployment system gets a lot of money. Every social safety net program got a little bump. There's a lot in there. A little over $2 trillion was spent, and the agencies are now beginning the process of getting the money at the door, or at least putting together the systems to allocate that money going forward. There already is momentum for another stimulus bill, but I think realistically, this won't be done for at least a month. I think most lawmakers will want to see how the first three stimulus bills impacted the economy and our healthcare systems going forward, and they'll wait until around May 1 to see what kind of impact these measures have had. So while we'll all read about certain suggestions that Republicans and Democrats and President Trump will make about what should be in the next stimulus bill, there is nothing close to an agreement yet in Washington about what such a stimulus bill would have. I think that if the situation on the ground is better by May 1, and I think many people believe it will be, this situation may lose the urgency that guided Stimulus 3 to be passed in such a quick manner. And without that urgency, you likely won't see the same level of bipartisanship that existed in the bill that was just signed into law. So I think Stimulus 4 will be much more difficult to pass. It'll be much more diverse in what people want. There won't be a natural starting point. For instance, the House took the lead on Stimulus 2. The Senate took the lead on Stimulus 3. Both will act in their own ways without regard to what the other is doing. And I think it's this Stimulus 4 is much likely to become more of a partisan fight than an agreement, unless, of course, the situation on the ground is as dire as it is today. And in that case, a Stimulus 4 bill would probably sail through again with a handful of pretty far-reaching provisions.
Right. John, just a follow-up to that question is, you know, I'm sure this is something that many Americans are thinking is, should we be concerned with the amount of national debt that we're adding through all of these stimulus packages?
Well, I think we should be, and I think that some lawmakers are thinking about that, but clearly we're in a situation where I think most lawmakers believe we've got to throw the kitchen sink at this crisis and worry about the deficits later. That's the sentiment guiding decision-making today. I think that you'll see more deficit concerns around any possibility of a Stimulus 4 plan. And frankly, the deficit is just not a big issue right now. So I think lawmakers are willing to kind of put that aside and revisit that later once we get beyond this crisis.
Thank you, John. So, Lita, in addition to the fiscal package from lawmakers, we also have seen unprecedented monetary stimulus measures from the U.S. Federal Reserve. Let me ask you, what's the significance of the Fed's actions so far that we've seen?
Fed took two major actions in the last couple of weeks and many minor ones that any other time would be considered major. First, with the help from Treasury, they have started a program to buy corporate bonds in conjunction with a facility to lend to corporations directly. Basically, you know, what they said is additional Fed cuts and buying Treasuries are too inadequate or slow to provide liquidity to the parts of the market that need it immediately. So we will bypass those and banks, and we'll go directly to the source of the problem. This was previously done, actually, by the European Central Bank and Bank of Japan. So even though it was unique here in the U.S., it was tried pretty wide in a, you know, pretty widespread fashion before. The second thing they did is more important and will have far-reaching effects. Basically, by committing to open-ended, both size and timing-wise, quantitative easing, they're saying they will keep the rates low all through throughout the yield curve, no matter what it takes, in a time when fiscal spending and treasury supplies is increasing significantly. This is important. This is a new paradigm in the sense that monetary authorities are keeping yields low so that fiscal side can spend more. How this plays out in the long run will be very interesting to see. And as for, you know, in terms of, it will have impact in terms of how we think about portfolios.
And on a related note, Salita, how does Fed bond buying and low rates impact fixed income positioning?
Yeah, I mean, as for our fixed income portfolios, of course, especially short-dated treasuries lose some of their attractiveness. Because they basically have no yield. But since Fed is buying investment-grade corporate bonds, and especially in the very front end, We see value adding on that front, adding to the fixed income allocation in our portfolios.
Great, thank you. Mike Ryan, let me ask you to join us again, and I wanted to talk about equity markets with you, and we're already seeing questions coming in from our listeners, and a lot of them about what's going on in equities. So we keep seeing headlines about being in a bear market. Maybe you can just explain to us what that actually means and where opportunities exist right now in this environment.
So first of all, what is a bear market? I think there's a technical definition that when you have a up until you get about a 20% correction in markets, it's just that, it's a market correction. Once you reach that 20% move from the prior levels, what you typically get is it's identified as a bear market. So if you look at major indices, and that is the Dow, the S&P, NASDAQ, and even if you look at the Russell 2000, you know, we've hit what would be considered a bear market. So I think, you know, people are defining this as a bear market. And now the question, of course, is, you know, bear markets are of different duration. They tend to be brutish, nasty, but also relatively short, which is merciful. The question, of course, is how do you begin to position as you emerge from the bear market, and how should we be positioning right now? And I think in equities, what we see right now is opportunities in the following places. First of all, we do see opportunities in companies with earnings that should prove to be, you know, pretty resilient, even in our virus scenarios, that is our base case, but also our risk scenarios. And also in cyclical sectors that we think certainly face risk, but we think a lot of those risks have already been fully priced and therefore the equities have been oversold. But we also think there's a second opportunity in where we identify some of the longer term secular themes that we had pointed out in our Decade Ahead report that came out at the end of last year, and focus on those secular themes that should outperform as consumer behavior shifts and as companies begin to evolve in response to COVID-19. So let me focus on each of those areas a little more in depth. So in the first one, we did write a report that we called our discriminating buyers. And here it was highlighting our highest conviction ideas for investors who might be looking to add some risk exposure given the recent sell-off in markets. And we focused on 18 companies that cut across 9 different sectors. It was communication services, consumer discretionary, consumer staples, industrials, information technology, real estate, but also included financials and utilities. So what I would say is that's a great way of looking at more defensively positioned companies that have already, we think, reflected a lot of the downside risks that are priced into the virus scenarios, but also their fundamentals are solid on a long-term basis. Now, in the second report, we discussed how the coronavirus pandemic serves as a catalyst to accelerate some of the secular shifts that we see happening in 3 key areas of transformation. Now, I mentioned before, Anthony, in a Decade Ahead report, we talked about a number of long-term themes. Well, there are 3 of them that we think that in the near term, coronavirus can serve as a catalyst for acceleration. And one is health. This includes genetic therapies, it's health tech, but it's also the safety and security of our food systems. The second is digital transformation. And I think we're all beginning to experience that right now as we begin to live, work, and play remotely. That's only been exacerbated by this issue of social distancing now. And there are all sorts of enabling technologies that surround that, include e-commerce, fintech, but also protecting the information and the data and the integrity of processes, which is going to be through cybersecurity. And then lastly, I do think one of the things that certainly was highlighted even before the advent of COVID-19, and this was probably first highlighted by the trade conflict we have with China, is the fact that we're more globally integrated than we've been in any time. It also means we're more vulnerable now to disruptions in global supply chains. But one of the things we do see playing out now is the trend towards deglobalization and how it's going to affect the manufacturing and also supply chain. So those are the ways we would do this, Anthony. Again, opportunistically looking at companies that we think have strong values, will weather the short-term storm that's a part of COVID-19, but also some of those companies that are identified as some of those longer-term themes that COVID-19 will play as a catalyst for unlocking value.
Mike, also, I wanted to ask you about what's happening in oil today. If you look at WTI crude, it's up about 22% this afternoon. And, you know, we saw a tweet this morning from the president today regarding oil output cuts. What do we know?
So, Anthony, let's remind everyone that we didn't get hit with one exogenous shock. We actually got hit by 2. So the first exogenous shock is what's been dominated the press, and we've all been just overwhelmed with stories about COVID-19. And that certainly was the biggest exogenous shock. But there was a second exogenous shock, and that came out of the energy patch, and that was the failure of OPEC and Russia to reach a production limit agreement, which meant then that oil prices would likely decline. In fact, not only did they fail to reach a production limit agreement, but in fact what they did is they entered into a price war, and what you saw is that energy prices just cascaded lower. In fact, we had one of the steepest sell-offs we've seen in the energy patch, and when there was concerns, of course, is that this price war could trigger significant dislocations within the energy sector, especially in the U.S., where we have a higher cost of production in a number of the different energy companies and energy fields. What you heard today was the president had talked about a conversation he had with the crown prince in Saudi Arabia, who in turn had a conversation with Vladimir Putin. And I think, again, I'd be careful to take all the things that were said in the tweet literally, but I think what it does highlight is that there's a general recognition now that having a price war in the middle of this collapse in demand doesn't serve anyone's purpose. And what they want to see is a stabilization of energy prices, because they don't want to see that further destabilize the real economy, but also sectors of the financial market. But I do think what the underlying issue here is, Anthony, and why the market is supported by this, is perhaps the recognition by the key players, OPEC, especially Saudi Arabia, Russia, and also to some extent the United States, that a price war doesn't serve anyone's purpose, and therefore we're likely to see some production cuts and pricing discipline maintained now in the energy sector.
Terrific. Thank you, Mike. Appreciate that. John, let me ask you about the U.S. election, because no matter what, at the end of the day, we're still having an election this coming November. It sort of has taken a bit of a backseat, however, to everything going on now with the COVID-19 pandemic. So how do you actually see coronavirus impacting the election this year?
Yeah, Anthony, the election clearly has taken a backseat. Some people on the call may actually like that, so that could be good news in some ways. The virus has completely rewritten the narrative for this election. This election was supposed to be about, if you're on the Donald Trump team, then this election was all about him being reelected on the basis of a strong economy, of solid market performance, and of him standing up to China, and also pushing back on socialism. If you were a Democrat and in the Biden camp, this election was all about a referendum on Donald Trump, the person, on Donald Trump, the man, whether he had the temperament to be president, whether he was the right guy to lead us in these interesting times. Those narratives have been completely upended, and it's very possible that this race could be a referendum on Donald Trump's performance as a crisis manager. We're likely to see him perform in this role over the next couple months. You've seen it over the last month. That's what people are thinking about today. Things should be better by November. The economy should be recovering if the experts are right. But I think that this crisis is going to overshadow all these things, because we're certainly not going to have the same economy, the same market that we had at that point. And people's view of Trump, it may not necessarily change, but it will be amplified by how he did as a crisis manager. And we still don't really know the answer to that. Well, we have seen a slight uptick in his approval ratings over the last couple of weeks. Most of the polls show that people perform approve of his performance so far as a crisis manager by anywhere between 50% and 60%, which is pretty good for him, considering where his approval ratings have been over the last couple of years. So this is an opportunity for him to add something else to his resume, to prove to people that he is capable of managing in times of a crisis. I don't know what people will believe in November, but it looks like now that the election will turn eventually into a referendum on Trump and his role as crisis manager. We've already seen the election season completely upended. Candidates are not doing much on the road. They're not doing. They're not involved in the activities that they've usually been involved with as candidates. They're not out shaking hands. They're not out at public events. They're not raising money in person. They're basically sidelined. This probably works to the benefit of the incumbent and against a challenger, particularly in the House and Senate races where the challenger may not be as well known. Probably doesn't have a big impact on the presidential race unless Trump either does very well or does very poorly as crisis manager. And as I mentioned earlier, that's just it's too early to know what the assessment of him will be. But for the House and Senate races, probably a good thing for incumbents at this time, since it's harder for a challenger to be noticed in this period of general invisibility for them.
Right. And considering Joe Biden is really a big fan of those rallies, and which can't happen right now, that's a big, you know, big blight on his campaign as it stands today. So, Mike, your team recently published an Election Watch report looking at the policy agenda of both President Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden. So what are the key takeaways in terms of market impact, and how should investors be thinking about the election in general?
Well, first of all, Anthony, when we wrote that report, we worked really closely with John and his team. And I think, the insight that John just shared with everyone is the insight that we've relied on. I think it's been, again, we're fortunate to have a public policy office that has the ability to kind of read through some of the political dynamics and help us understand the potential for electoral outcomes. So I think that has been incredibly helpful for us as we deliver more, as we try and develop macro and market scenarios based on electoral outcomes. The one thing that I think is tough in this in terms of a market is that, you know, there are no election playbooks or pandemic. You know, we certainly had elections during wars, during periods of social unrest, during natural disasters, but we haven't really seen something like this before, especially when you're talking about things like social distancing and mobility restrictions, which, to your point, Anthony, it kind of changes the way you can campaign. So what I would say is it interjects an element of uncertainty into the electoral outcome, and it changes, as John pointed out rightly, that it changes the dynamics on what we'll be judging candidates for and how we'll be assessing who we want as commander-in-chief. I also think one of the things we have to recognize is that, you know, we don't know exactly what will happen between now and November either. If you think about, let's go back 9 weeks ago. Let's think about what we know and we didn't know. So 9 weeks ago, we didn't know who the Democratic nominee was, but we were pretty certain it wasn't going to be Joe Biden. At least that's the way we were hearing from a lot of their polls. 9 weeks ago, most of us had not heard about or had only begun to hear about COVID-19, but it seemed to be a regional issue with China. We've seen the world change dramatically for us. So what we have to recognize, of course, is that there's more likely to happen between now and the November election. Just today, that I believe that the Democratic Party postponed their scheduling of the Democratic Convention, which means, you know, that's probably another complicating factor here. So we have to focus then on, okay, well, what is likely to come out of this election? Now, I still think from a macro and market perspective, there are two things that we'll focus on. One is going to be the fiscal impact, and the other is going to be the regulatory impact. Now, one of the things that, as John alluded to, might have been a bigger issue in the past would have been, you know, how the two parties were judged on, you know, what their fiscal policies were that included spending. I think that's kind of out right now, because I think, you know, you're looking to try and provide as much support to the economy. But I don't think that will be a primary issue in this election, at least not for market participants. So I think what we'll focus on is how they're going to view taxes. That's the corporate tax rate. You know, we know that, you know, Biden has talked about he wants to, you know, raise the corporate tax rate. You know, Trump has talked about, you know, potentially cutting the corporate tax rate, or at least making the current tax rate more permanent. And then also even in personal tax rates, you know, Biden has talked about raising them, while Trump is, again, talking about locking in the tax cuts that were part of the last tax reform. Now, I really think, though, what we're going to hinge on is the regulatory side. And it's really in four areas. It's in healthcare, where there are pretty big distinctions between the two parties. It's in financial services, where you're seeing, you know, while President Trump would like to see further regulatory easing of burden, what you're seeing is on the Democratic side, you'd like to see a re-regulation and the reversal of some of the deregulation we've seen. Certainly in energy policy, there's a real stark difference between the two parties. And then lastly, in technology, it's still evolving views of the two parties. But I do think there are some distinctions in technology. So for us from a market perspective, what will be critical is who's in the White House, but also the composition of Congress that will make some critical decisions, again, both in terms of corporate and personal taxes, as well as appointing the people who are going to make the decisions on the regulatory front and what that regulatory landscape will look like.
Thank you, Mike. And Salida, before we get to the audience questions, which there are a number coming in, wanted to ask you, with so much volatility and uncertainty around the virus and the election, what should investors do if they're looking to put new cash to work today?
To us, there is one asset class that stands out as the right place to add some risk right now, and that is credit. The repricing we saw in credit was worse than equities. Also, historically, after big disruptions, credit tends to lead the recovery of growth markets. So when you look at the credit markets, maybe I'll just go through a couple of them that we find levels favorable places right now. High yield credit, for example, is attractive because we believe it prices in a much worse downside scenario than equities. And within U.S. high yield, investors should brace for higher defaults, for sure, especially in sectors hard hit by COVID-19, such as leisure and energy. But we believe spreads more than compensate for the default risk right now. And then we also like, you know, emerging market dollar-denominated sovereign debt, because we believe the policymakers understand that this is a global pandemic and will be supportive of emerging market countries as those countries struggle with the virus. Obviously, we have seen Fed recently extend its swap lines to include emerging market central banks. They have allowed other major central banks who hold treasuries, both them as collateral, and to be able to get access to dollars as well. So this is just one thing that Fed do. But in general, I think between central banks and other global organizations, like IMF, they're going to be here supporting at least the larger issuers of emerging, larger emerging market countries. And finally, we like investment-grade corporate bonds, and as I mentioned before, especially shorter-term bonds, because they provide significant pickup over treasuries, even when Fed is buying both. So you can think about this almost as a follow the Fed themed investment, because Fed is now behind it. And then a bit more risky, but also a very decent risk return profile is in fixed rate preferred securities. This is obviously for our U.S. clients, it has tax advantages. They have qualified dividend treatment. One can get really high quality issuers with prefers at yielding close to 6% yield, which is obviously a significant pickup over risky rates. So rather than adding risk in equities, which is already pricing in our base case scenario and will be volatile as number of cases and fatalities rise in the U.S., our preferred asset class is now credit. And last week, actions by Fed and fiscal authorities has given us confidence in our credit call, where we see an asymmetric risk return profile. So might talk about a number of equity sectors for long-term themes and a limited number of companies, less than 20 that we highlighted as high quality. Those are, I think, unique opportunities. But when you look at all the overall asset class, we find the risk return more favorable at this time in credit over equity.
Thank you, Salida. Appreciate it. So we did receive a number of questions, and let me get to some of them here as we have a few minutes left. Mike, I'll start with you. The question is, what sectors have fallen the most and are maybe positioned to rebound more quickly?
So, Anthony, it's not surprising that when you have this kind of a sudden deceleration in economic activity and a significant repricing in the market, that the areas that are going to be most affected are going to be the most economically sensitive sectors and the most cyclical sectors. So it tends to be areas like materials, it's areas like energy, it's also areas, certain parts of consumer discretionary. And certainly it's going to be areas, the industrials, especially when you have a disruption to international activity because of the disruption to global supply chain. What I'd be really careful about is when people are looking at, I had a lot of people saying they want to play a rebound and play a bounce. I think we have to be careful, and I'd be really hesitant to try and take a, you know, kind of what I call a timing the bottom of cyclical recovery. I would instead prefer to look at it in a measured way. That's why we identified those 18 stocks that we talked about discriminating buyers, because they cut across a number of sectors, including the ones I just talked about. But it's not just a pure bet on one or two sectors bouncing back. And one area I would especially be careful about right now is the energy sector, because as we saw today, it's going to be prone to volatility that sits beside what's happening in COVID-19. Because I mentioned from the outset, there's that other exogenous shock that was the failure of the parties to come to a production agreement. So that's another variable you have to account for. So rather than simply try and play sectors one by one, let's be more discriminating here. Let's look across sectors at the companies that we still hold value, where we don't think that the long-term earnings power of the company has been compromised. But we do think that they've priced to the level where they discount a lot of the risk. And again, that's the discriminating buyers list that we talked about, Anthony.
Thanks, Mike. So, Lita, maybe you could answer this next question. Should I be averaging back into stocks on down days?
Okay. So, I think the key there is averaging using dollar cost averaging. I think it is a very prudent strategy right now. And that's why, you know, normally when there's a big sell-off, you know, when we see a dip in the market, what we like to do is basically rebalance right after that. You want to get your target. And in this case, obviously, we're dealing with a whole different scenario. As we mentioned, there's a lot more volatility that is waiting for us. So I think rebalancing obviously is important. But on top of that, I think there's going to be a time where equities will recover in a much stronger way. But it's not going to be tomorrow. So dollar cost averaging, I think, is a very prudent strategy, and that's how we would go about it.
Great. Thanks, Alita. John, a question for you. How could the stimulus around COVID-19 impact spending on other initiatives over the next few years?
Well, it could have the result of lawmakers feeling the need to act on deficit reduction, which would likely limit spending. But I think it probably won't have that impact, at least for a year or two. And particularly with the Congress, with the House and Senate likely to be divided politically, you're likely to see spending kind of inch along as it's been doing over the last couple of years. Republicans want more defense spending. Democrats want more non-defense spending. The compromise over the last 4 or 5 years has been to give both sides a little bit of boost in spending, maybe a 5% increase. And although that's added money to the deficit, that seems to be where the political solution has been in divided government. And my sense is that we'll continue to see divided government, and we'll continue to see that kind of outlook on spending going forward. I think the deficit is probably going to be resolved down the road in a few years, like, for instance, maybe around the time that the tax cuts enacted in 2017, they expire in 2025. And at that point, depending on the makeup of Washington, they'll have to be reinstated. Require a proactive act of Congress to extend them. There may be disagreement over that in a divided government, and that could open the door for a talk on deficit reduction that wouldn't be had over the next couple of years, because there's no major milestone that Congress has to deal with. So I think deficit reduction is probably not it's not in the cards over the next couple of years. Although I would say that a second-term president is much more likely to deal with it than a first-term president. So if Trump's reelected, you could see action on deficit reduction, although Trump hasn't shown a lot of interest in that so far. But he could, because of the realities of a second-term president who doesn't have to be on the ballot again. So you could see it, but I think we're probably a few years away from that being an issue that we talk about on a day-to-day basis.
Thanks, John. Mike, couple more questions, and maybe you can answer this one. What do we see? What does the CIO see as the worst case scenario for the markets and the economy?
So in order to talk about the worst case scenarios for the economy and the markets, first you have to stretch back to what you see as the worst case scenario then for COVID-19, because I do think these are linked. So what we would see is, if, in that case, if we were to see that containment efforts and mitigation efforts were to fail in having the disease crest in, say, mid to late April, if this stretched into May or June, and that we saw that there was actually recurrences of the disease. One of the things that Salita mentioned, which I think was important, is that we see reinfection rates in parts of Asia where the view had been that it largely been contained. But if we suddenly see a reinfection rate there as social distancing measures relax, that obviously raises concerns, because then what you'll see is you have to reimpose measures, or the measures that currently exist in certain countries couldn't be rolled back, which means then that you would the economic recovery would be pushed back even further, and that the deceleration in activity would be even deeper. What you could see then is that without further follow-up by the federal government, which is something that John alluded to, is that you would see bankruptcies, you would see people who are at least temporarily kept on the payrolls during this interim period or without jobs. So you'd see massive dislocations in the economy. So what you'd see is that the recession that we're now penciling in would be much more significant and would likely last longer than we've estimated. In that case, what you'd see is that earnings estimates for the S&P 500, as well as global earnings estimates, would likely be cut even further. Now, keep in mind, we cut our estimates this year down to $130 a share for the S&P 500. That's a significant reduction in our earnings forecast. We'd have to lower it even further from there if we saw a more broad-based and longer-lasting recession. So then we'd be talking about a year-end pricing for the S&P 500 that would likely be closer to 2100 as opposed to 2650. Now, I want to emphasize something, Anthony, that would be our risk case scenario. That's not our highest probability. Our base case is still that we see containment efforts beginning to show some progress in mid to late April. We begin to see some relaxing of these mobility restrictions and social distancing measures by late May. And then what you see is by year end, you've got equity prices recovering as we start to see more evidence that the economy is emerging from recession.
Terrific, thanks, Mike. So, Lita, another we have a couple of questions that have come in on fixed income. So maybe I'll combine them a little bit. One is, what's the outlook for muni bonds in this type of environment? A lot of questions about that, and also the Treasury markets. How do you think that they're going to fare in the coming months after significant volatility there?
Okay, so maybe let's start with the muni market. So in this sell-off, it was very interesting because we always think about the muni market as being closer to the treasury market than the credit market, right? But in this sell-off, munis actually, anything that had a little bit of a credit component to it acted like a credit market, meaning that the market sell-off has created buying opportunities in munis, but especially in the short term. So the tax-exempt yields increased markedly in the face of extraordinary volatility. We have seen indiscriminate sell-off across sectors and significant price declines. In fact, high-yield muni as a whole suffered the biggest losses, about 20% or so. And we have seen major outflows in this market. From, I would say, about the largest weekly withdrawals we've seen in almost 30 years. There's been forced selling by asset managers to meet redemptions. So really, this has been a lot of damage in terms of the pricing of the muni market. So it's kind of bad news that the munis acted this way in this sell-off, but good news because some opportunities have risen. Our focus is on the five-year point of the curve. We don't want to go too far. And that's where we have the main thing that we look at in munis. Muni to treasury ratios have surged to hit record highs. So we're looking 5 years in short dated, high quality, AA and AAA munis. From a sector standpoint, we think public power and water and sewer utilities will witness the least economic impact from this virus. By contrast, airports and not-for-profit hospitals are the most vulnerable to the impact from the virus, and the state government sector faces some moderate credit risk due to short-term budget pressures and longer-term pension funding issues. So bottom line is short-dated, high-quality munis have reached levels, yield levels we haven't seen in many, many years, and that would be an area that we would add on.
Thank you so much. And John, I'll ask the last question of you that came in. And Mike mentioned this earlier, is that the DNC has officially delayed until August, the convention, I should say. Sorry about that. So the DNC is going to delay the convention until August. So what's the impact of this delay, John, do you think?
Well, I think it probably hurts Democrats in the following manner. It prevents the reconciliation of Biden and Bernie Sanders to come together and for Sanders to accept Biden as the nominee. That would have happened in earlier, but now that's going to happen a month later. So that is the kind of the final straw of the Democratic Party's dilemma in this nominating process, is to make sure that they're all united behind one person rather than to have a second person out there in the wings kind of challenging the number one. So it'll keep alive Bernie Sanders as the backup candidate. I don't think Bernie Sanders can win the nomination at this point, but he would be standing there if something were to happen to Biden, and I'm not suggesting that anything will, but he will remain most viable backup if there's a complication. So it probably hurts Democrats that the process will be prolonged. The good news for Republicans and Democrats who both have the convention in August is that they don't have to, compete against the Tokyo Summer Olympics, which they're having to do at an earlier time. But I think the delay probably hurts Democrats a little bit, but not in a significant way.
Terrific. Thank you so much, John. And as we're wrapping up, we always like to ask the elevator question. So if you were on an elevator with a UBS client, obviously with when their social distancing actually comes back into play. So let's say it happens, but we're without the social distancing cues. So if you're on an elevator with a client right now, what would you tell them in 30 seconds or less? John, since you were just going, let me ask you.
I would tell them to be happy with this time of bipartisanship that we're in right now, which is mostly the result of Washington being a ghost town, but it will return with a vengeance once things become more normal and we get closer to the elections in November.
Thank you, John. So, Lita, same question to you.
So, Anthony, I'll just take 1 second to finish the answer, because you asked me about the treasuries and I didn't finish that last time.
Oh, thank you.
I want to make sure we answer that question our client had. So the Fed is buying treasuries in unlimited amounts and as long as it takes, and trying to keep the cost of fiscal stimulus as low as possible. So I would say, we might see occasional volatility in a given day, but treasury rates are going to be stay low for the foreseeable future. And I wouldn't be surprised when push comes to shove, they try to push the yields close to zero as possible across the curve, because we have at some point have to pay the price for this fiscal stimulus. In terms of the elevator question, yes, probably not the right time to be on elevator with anyone, but right now. But on a more serious note, I would say in this tumultuous time, we are here for you. We're working 24/7 around the world as a global team to translate all the developments and provide timely advice to stay the course, and ultimately time will be on our side.
Thank you so much, Salita. And Mike Ryan, last word to you.
So what I would say, Anthony, first of all, is let's remember that typically we give investment guidance and advice to our clients, but I also think that the advice right now I'd be giving people is about not only protecting your portfolios, but protecting your safety and your health and your families. So, you know, the guidance we're getting from public health officials, let's all take it seriously. Let's take social distancing measures seriously. The simple things we can do, like washing our hands. I know it sounds so incredibly simple, but when we talk to healthcare providers, how important that is can't be exaggerated. So I would say address, first of all, the safety issues with your family. The second thing I would say is that it's probably a good idea to turn off the news at some point during the day, because I think we're all being overwhelmed and we're being hit with an onslaught of news, and a lot of it's recycled information. Try to be careful to not overexpose yourself to news. And then lastly, what I'll say is that I'll follow up on one of the things Felice said. I think she said it well. Look, markets will recover. We will get past this. And one of the things that we do see is that even though we face a challenge right now in the crisis, never underestimate man's ingenuity and ability to problem solve. And we have a lot of bright people on this planet right now all working to solve the same problem. And there's not many times on this planet when you can say that, when you've got all the best minds across the planet united for common purpose. So I would take that as one of the most encouraging things that we can look forward to from this point.
Terrific. Thank you so much, Mike. Great words and a great way to end our conversation today. Mike Ryan, Chief Investment Officer, Americas. Also, we were joined today by Salita Marcelli, Deputy CIO, as well as John Savercool, the head of the UBS U.S. Office of Public Policy. Thank you all for joining us, and thanks for all of our listeners here. And just one quick thing I wanted to mention is that if you're a U.S. client or a prospect listening in and you're interested in learning about the list of stock and bond ideas that Mike had mentioned throughout this conversation, you can reach out to your UBS financial advisor to receive a copy of the title of the piece. It is Ideas for Discriminating Buyers. It's an investment strategy insights report published by the Chief Investment Officer, and that was on March 23rd. So make sure to get a copy of that. Plus, I have to say there have been a number of publications, many, published by the team since everything happened here with COVID-19 and the pandemic, and the research and the strategy that has been done by the team is just unbelievable. And you can get a lot of that, not only from your FA, but you can also follow Mike Ryan on LinkedIn. Everything that they post on the publications from the CIO comes to you from that method, as well as reaching out to your FA. So make sure to follow Mike on LinkedIn. Thanks again for all the questions. I'm sorry if we couldn't get to all of them. There were a lot of them that came in. But if you do have any additional questions, also your financial advisor is a terrific resource. From New York, I'm Anthony Pastore. Thank you all. Stay safe and healthy, everyone, and we'll speak with you soon.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/workingwithus. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.